Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch and Globetrotter. This is show number 148. Now, I know what you're saying. You've missed a couple of shows and so on, so this really should be show 150. But we don't count like that. We only count the shows we've done. This is 148. Next week is 149. And then if you're lucky, we'll have some fancy show for our 150th. Today, you're with Zoe from People's Dispatch. And Mika is back with us, our special guest. Tough, tough week again in Gaza. The ordinance numbers are now out. 25,000 tons of explosive dropped on Gaza. For comparison, Hiroshima, 15,000 tons. We're approaching twice the Hiroshima levels of ordnance dropped on Gaza. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, we're either near 10,000 dead or over 10,000 dead. Very difficult for them to keep track of what's happening. Israeli tanks surrounding Gaza City. There are deaths taking place at places like Jabalia. There are deaths taking place inside Gaza City. Just don't have any idea how many people have died because people are not able in some cases to access hospitals. So the death toll is not really accurate any longer. Israeli tanks, as I said, inside the province of Gaza at Saladin Street, which cuts Gaza north and south. The most significant event and long awaited was the speech today by Syed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah. Now, as is common, those who know understand that big screens were placed across Lebanon in Beirut, in the southern part of Beirut, in the southern cities and so on, large-scale production for his speech. Nasrallah spoke for over an hour. Nasrallah has the characteristic of an academic. He goes slow. He explains what's happening. This is what he said. He said, number one, that Hezbollah stands unequivocally with the people of Palestine, with Gaza, of course, but if all Palestine. Secondly, Mr. Nasrallah said that already Hezbollah has been in various forms of conflict with the Israeli soldiers at the northern frontier of Israel. In fact, those have indeed been quite controversial because Amnesty International has already released a report saying that in its fight with Hezbollah, the Israeli military has used illegal white phosphorus. Mr. Nasrallah said that the fighters of Hezbollah, maybe up to 100,000 of them, are amassed, they are ready. There are people quite brave to remain at the border and fire. Now, what he said was, continuing this low-level warfare with Israel has allowed Hezbollah to pin down Israeli troops and prevent them from being diverted to Gaza. You might ask, why didn't Syed Hassan Nasrallah declare war against Israel? The reason he didn't, he said, is it's not the time yet. We're going slowly. We are methodical. He said, if the Americans think, and he called this war on Gaza an American war, he said, if the Americans think that they're going to have the upper hand here, they're not. And he warned, he said, that we will take out your battleships in the Eastern Mediterranean. You were defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq. You were defeated three times in Lebanon. You will be defeated again. It was a very powerful speech, but it wasn't exactly a declaration of war. It was something just about short of that. He did say the United States is deeply isolated, Zoe, deeply isolated, not just in this conflict, but also yesterday at the UN General Assembly, deeply isolated, a vote on Cuba. Tell us about that.
Well, this is, I think, a moment that people have been watching yearly for the past 30 years that this vote has taken place. It's the resolution which Cuba proposes to condemn the unilateral blockade of Cuba imposed by the United States. This is a vote that, again, for 30 years has been passed with an absolute majority, with very, very few exceptions, abstaining or voting against. And this year was even more overwhelming than last year. Only two countries voted against. This was US and Israel. And they, of course, historically have always voted against this resolution. Again, we know that the UN General Assembly resolutions are not binding. However, they do represent a very important indication of both where the world stands and also for these countries to kind of take their own stand and say, no, we're still not going to support this resolution. And in the speeches that were given by different diplomats about the resolution and why they were supporting it or why they were against it, we saw many people talking about the humanitarian toll that this blockade has had on the Cuban people. We've covered this a lot on the show, that not only are the people of Cuba facing this suffocating 60-year plus blockade, which was imposed just a few years after they stood up to US imperialism and established a revolution with a socialist character, but in during the Trump administration, Cuba was put on the state sponsor of terrorism list, which is essentially taking the blockade and amplifying it to an extreme degree. Again, we have covered what is the impact of both the blockade and the designation of state sponsor of terrorism list. Many commentators pointed out that this vote and this discussion about how the US can pursue this extremely unilateral, not based in fact, both designation of the SSOT, but also the blockade of Cuba, while they are funding and bankrolling currently the most rogue state in the world, Israel, which receives billions of dollars in U.S. aid every single year and is currently carrying out this genocidal massacre of the Palestinian people. On the other hand, you have Cuba, who sends doctors to dozens of countries, which trains Palestinian doctors, which trains doctors who are currently in the Gaza Strip saving lives. And yet, not only are they strangleholded by the United States, not only are they unable to import crucial products for their production, for their health sector, for their science sector, but also they're stigmatized. International banks do not want to do business with Cuba. So it's one of these great contradictions where you see, once again, the people of the world, the majority of the world represented in the United Nations, is saying no to this blockade of Cuba, no to these unilateral sanctions, and yes to Cuban doctors, yes to Cuban medicine, yes to Cuban science. And of course, the US, Israel, you know, voting against this, and Ukraine, another huge recipient of US aid, also abstaining. So I think, again, as these votes, which happen every year, are often watched as kind of an indication of where world leaders are standing on the Cuba issue. The US is never going to, of course, vote against itself and its own policy. But more and more, I think, and as you said, Vijay, with the US's position on Israel, it really is becoming more and more isolated. People are saying, not only are we against this policy because of how it impacts the Cuban people, but if the US is capable of doing this to Cuba, then what is it going to do to us? And I think also when we saw the anti-colonial coups happening across West Africa and the response of the West, people recognize that the West is very, very quick, very, very quick to not only abandon its propped up leaders, but also people who are going to have real material impacts of these sanctions, of these blockades, and they're going to be left out in the dust. So people are more and more recognizing this and saying, standing with the US may have short-term benefits. In the long term, they're not going to take care of your interests. So once again, this UNGA vote, a testament to the thermometer of where the people of the world stand with Cuba and where do they stand with the US's policies.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. United States are continuing to do heavy sanctions on Cuba. It's in fact a blockade. It's not even an embargo, right? It's a heavy sanction. But their sanction habit doesn't seem to end. In the African continent, they have the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Now Biden, in the middle of all this, has said it's not only one country, but several countries are going to be thrown out of the AGOA. this act, which gives preferential trade, right, Mika?
Yeah, that's right. So essentially with AGOA, it would allow for, you know, duty-free products. I think it's around 2,000 duty-free products to enter the US, which of course gives certain benefits to the producing country. But of course, in Biden's words, it was due to, in his words, gross violations of human rights, which in this moment is, you know, is abhorrent for him to say that. And so Niger is one of, I think, eight African countries who are on the U.S. sanctions list. There are individual African leaders who are also on the sanctions list, but most of them find themselves on this list, not necessarily because of the so-called Gross Human Violations Act, but because they are choosing paths that are against the U.S.'s political and economic interests. And of course, since the coup in July in Niger, most Western aid, most Western trade has slowed down. Aid has been cut off. But of course, they kind of are retrospectively kind of trying to reposition themselves as being the ones who are, we are pulling out, when in fact, we know the people of Niger spoke loud and clear, pushing back and calling for the French to leave, which most of the French ambassador left in September. Many of the troops have already left. But interestingly, even though they're trying to break economic ties or to shrink their economic opportunities, because right now Niger is also faced with ECOWAS sanctions from countries in the region that only, as we know, serve to punish the people, not necessarily dent the support for the government in many ways. But interestingly, on the 26th of October, I think it was, the US Senate voted down a bill that would have required US military troops to withdraw from Niger. And I think this is important to note because right now they have about 1,000 troops. And after the coup, they moved out of the capital of Niamey to Agadez, where the drone base, one of the largest U.S. drone bases, is operating in the region. And this is, of course, important for two reasons. Is one, they might pull out economically, but in fact, it seems more like a tactic to try to squeeze them out. But they won't withdraw militarily because, of course, they not only have the interest of trying to keep a presence in the Sahel to monitor the east, of course, to monitor what will happen with the significant uranium ore that's in the region, as well as other mineral resources, but of course to ensure that they push back against China, which I wanted to say on the other hand, today actually the Niger government announced that a 2,000 kilometer oil pipeline to Benin would be constructed in the region on the east side, which is relatively undeveloped because it's quite a desertified area. And so they spoke about how they were going to resume and ensure that the construction of this 2,000 kilometer pipeline to a very oil-rich area will continue. So of course, it's interesting that one, China has a big company that has a large stake in the oil pipeline. So it's interesting, we'll see how the US tries to monitor Chinese activities. As we know, their military presence is largely to push back against the geopolitical influence that China is gaining and the various development projects that are underway. And I think significantly, last point I'll end with is that during the commissioning ceremony, the energy ministers of Mali and Burkina Faso were present. And I think for the African people, this should be an interesting signifier, this increasing closeness and this kind of regional coordination that we're seeing in the region. Because, of course, we know that the continent of Africa, highly underdeveloped due to the legacies of colonialism and neocolonialism, would require developing our economies to regional economies of scale if we're going to see significant changes and opportunities to move away from the dependency we had largely on the West. But now we're seeing different opportunities rise in this interesting geopolitical moment we inhabit.
We got sanctions on the one side, we got opportunities on the other. You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch and Globetrotter. Great to be with you, 148th show. Somehow, Zoe, this entire show is about sanctions, because here we go again. Here in Guatemala, there's a new president, wins a landslide victory. There is a attempt to undermine his presidency, etc., etc., etc. Please tell us what that etc., etc. is in that country of Guatemala.
Well, perhaps Guatemala is slightly the exception, because this time it's not the United States trying to sanction Bernardo Arevalo and his Semilla movement party, but it is actually this legal battle between the courts. And Arevalo himself has actually received support from U.S. officials saying that the attacks on him and his party are undermining democracy. So it's an interesting situation. We've been covering it again since the midterm the first round of elections in Guatemala, even before that, because as we've said, the entire electoral process has been marred by irregularities, has been marred by a proscription, by parties being banned, by candidates being banned, by a lot of irregular moves to essentially stop any popular candidates who are going to challenge the status quo, who are going to challenge the system of corruption, to challenge the way elites have really been going about politics in the country, for the past period. And Bernardo Arevalo coming in first place in this first round of elections in the country was a huge shock, was a shock to the elites. And they quickly began to maneuver using largely the Supreme Electoral Court, other courts posing against each other. And there has been sort of this continuous development where the attorney general will do one thing and will say, okay, now the party's banned. Another court will fight back. And the latest update is actually quite significant because it is the electoral authorities who have now moved to suspend Bernardo Arevalo's party. They had previously actually been the last line of defense in some cases of democracy in Guatemala. Well, you saw the attorney general investigating his party, attempting to ban them. The electoral court was also getting raided by Guatemalan authorities. And now just this morning, the electoral authorities have said that they're going to ban this party. So what does this mean? Bernardo Arevalo is the president-elect in the country of the Semilla party, the movement party. He is set to be sworn in again in January. The back and forth has been tense. And this move is definitely going to shake things. As it happened in these past hours, it is unclear how is this going to shake out. How does this affect the votes? I think there is going to be a continued legal battle. And it really points to this crisis of liberal democracy, of where the elites were able to sway the vote for so many years. And the people have just had enough. And so not only on the side of these fights between the different courts, the different orders, the different developments there has been a sustained protest by indigenous movements, by people's movements in the country. Since October 2nd, there has been a national strike that was called for by indigenous movements. They marched all the way to the Capitol and had been holding a sit-in outside the presidential palace. Bernardo Arevalo himself greeted this movement, presented a letter to the president, Alejandro Giotamé. He has essentially given a carte blanche to the authorities to continue this persecution, despite the mandate of a president to ensure a peaceful transition of power. So it's definitely a concerning development, attacks to democracy, undermining democracy. However, I think the key thing to note here is that even if the institutions can be swayed, again, the Supreme Electoral Court had been defending the party, then was raided. It is the people who are going to continue to defend the mandate, to defend their votes on the streets. I think this latest move of the court banning the party is going to generate a significant backlash on the streets. People have had enough. They showed that not only with their votes in the first round and second round, but now they've said this is more than one candidate. This is about defending the democracy, which again has only been around for a few decades. Guatemala was under a seriously bloody dictatorship for several decades. A very, very tragic and traumatic civil war, which are wounds that are still being dealt with. And so this latest chapter is just another part of that. But they continue to defend this fragile democracy that they have.
So fragile democracy came out of a really terrible, terrible period. I remember well the massacres in that country in the 1980s, brutal period. There's a good reason why you're here with us, because we're associated with the website People's Dispatch. Terrific stuff there to read. Go and look at it. In fact, on the website, there's a story by Stanley Kwabla Arku on the Akosombo Dam spillage in Ghana. A terrific story. He's from Pan Africa TV. Mika, this is a real tragedy. Tens of thousands of people impacted by this dam spillage. This is the one story we're doing today, not about sanctions. Tell us a little bit about what has been happening in Ghana.
Well, so a couple of weeks ago, we saw that due to heavy rainfall, largely due to climate-related changes, that the Akosombo Dam, which is one of the biggest dam projects, in the 1960s, was the biggest dam project constructed under Nkrumah. It was a huge development project that was not only going to electrify, feed, and help to increase the economic productivity of the country, but was also going to help to be a productive force in the region. And so we've seen, and right now, initially it was 8,000 people who were displaced from 8 communities. Now it's gone up to 31,000. And this is from the great reporting of the colleague at People's Dispatch. But the bigger picture that I think is worth speaking about is the question of climate change and its disproportionate effect on the African continent and on the global south. We saw this in Pakistan, which, you know, has less than, correct me if I'm wrong, less than 1% contributing to carbon emissions. And right now, Africa is estimated in July 2023, that the loss and damages due to climate change would be projected between $290 billion to $400 billion annually. And that's huge amounts of money when we're struggling with a $100 billion infrastructural deficit each year. And that's only looking to increase as we experience more and more of these climate-related catastrophes. And importantly, I want to raise two things, is that one, a recent report by the IMF, of course, concludes that it's these fragile states who suffer from all these floods, droughts, et cetera. So it names Central African Republic, Somalia, Sudan, and mostly talks about how their inability to be governable people is why they're unable to deal with the situation. But of course, what they don't talk about when they keep talking about fragile states is that capitalism has contributed to this. We know that, you know, it's 100 of the world's largest companies are responsible for like 70% of carbon emissions. Right now, as the US continues to hold fast to pushing for war, pushing to increase their military budget, that's money that could be going to climate mitigation. As we know, there is a fund that is not getting any commitment from the Western historical pollutants in the Western countries. And in this particular moment, when we're seeing how our taxes, the US tax dollars of our colleague Zoe, are going to financing the killing of, you know, civilians in Palestine, it's extremely worrisome to see that the rest of the world, especially the European Union, has taken so long to just call for a ceasefire or reluctantly accept the resolution for a ceasefire. And I just want to mention that a colleague of ours, Gisela Hernandez, along with John Bellamy Foster, recently published an important study on Monthly Review, where they reveal the true spending, the actual spending using US defense budgets and different hidden budgets that aren't always taken into account by SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute for Peace Research, International Peace Research, where the actual US military budget they calculate is more than double what SIPRI estimates. SIPRI would have estimated the 2022 budget around just over, like, close to $900 billion, and it's actually $1.5 trillion US dollars. And so I think this is an important intervention in this moment that hopefully gets people galvanized around the reason why we have to have peace, because the world is flooding, is on fire, and we have no real option if we don't push our own spending into the right places, such as social services.
In the middle of all this, the United States government has got a new supplemental military budget, over $100 billion in that budget, $61.4 billion to Ukraine, $14.1 billion to Israel, in the middle of these two ongoing conflicts. Now, interesting, $61.4 billion to Ukraine. Earlier, Zoe said it was Ukraine and Israel that didn't vote to end the blockade on Cuba. No surprises there. I said most of our show is on sanctions. Well, after having passed a budget that sends $61.4 billion extra dollars to the Ukrainians to continue this war against Russia, United States decided to sanction some more country, some more individuals and companies. Well, this is interesting. They decided and found individuals and companies in Turkey, China, and the United Arab Emirates, these three countries, where they claim companies and individuals are selling the Russians technology whose end use is dual. It could either be civilian or military. And dual technologies are prohibited by the US government for sale to Russia right now. So they've gone and they've clamped down on these three countries, on companies and individuals in these three countries, Turkey, the UAE, and of course, China. Well, interestingly, the companies which were buying these technologies were mainly in the energy and finance sector and mining sector. Energy and mining sector. There was no direct invoice to a defense contractor. Look, let's not be naive. That doesn't mean that some of this technology might not have gone to an arms manufacturer, but that's not was written on the invoice. It's an interesting thing that's happening in the world. You see, the more these countries, particularly Russia and China, are getting sanctioned, and Iran, are getting sanctioned on issues of technology sales, the more they seem to be doing it, because they seem to be creating an entirely different world of technology creation, bypassing the Europeans and bypassing the United States. So in a way, this kind of sanctioning is isolating. It's not necessarily empowering. This doesn't strengthen the hand of the United States. It just means that these countries in Eurasia, in Europe and Asia, are building their own universe of technology trade. That's precisely what seems to be happening. And it turns out that these three countries, Turkey, China, and the United Arab Emirates, have been pretty vocal about their support for the Palestinians in Gaza. It's all one very peculiar churning of the world that we're seeing. You're listening to Give the People What They Want. We come to you from People's Dispatch, hopefully your favorite website to get movement-driven news, and from Globetrotter, it's show 148. Be back next week with 149, and then get ready for 150, and those selfies have to come back. See you later.